Dietitians are now saying one of our biggest problems is that we are thirsty all the time. They say hunger and thirst trigger the same signals to your brain, and so it is easy to get confused between the two. I wonder if sometimes we just can't tell how thirsty we are, if we just don't get what that means.
That's the Reverend Dr. Brian Coulter, and today he brings you a powerful message of faith for Lent entitled, It Was About Noon. I'm Peter Wallace, and this is Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Now to introduce this week's preacher, here's our host, Peter Wallace.
Thank you, Sherry. Today on Day One, we're delighted to welcome the Reverend Dr. Brian Christopher Coulter, senior pastor of First Presbyterian Church in Aiken, South Carolina. Brian earned his bachelor's degree from Oklahoma State University, a Master of Divinity degree from Columbia Theological Seminary, and a Doctor of Ministry from McCormick Theological Seminary. He is the author of Be Holy, published by Chalice Press, and writes for numerous publications. Brian, welcome to Day One.
Peter, thank you for having me. It's a privilege and an honor to be here.
You came to First Presbyterian Church in Aiken, South Carolina in 2014 after serving as associate pastor at Trinity Presbyterian Church in Fairhope, Alabama for a number of years. What was it about the church that drew you to accept the call in Aiken?
I was very excited to go there, and the atmosphere of the place was what sold it to me. You showed up and you could sense that the Spirit was in that place. And so I was very excited to talk with them and to learn more about not just the church, but also the community. And we just fell in love with it. And so one of their taglines there is writing a new chapter in an old story. And I found that to be very true. They come from a rich heritage and tradition, and we are writing a new chapter even today. And so I'm thrilled to participate and to be a part of that at First Pres in Aiken.
So what are some of the ministries and activities in that new chapter that have you excited?
Well, we've been stepping into a lot of new areas with mission. We're trying some new ways not only to give a hand out, but to do a hand up. And how do we really reach out and build connection and make those relationships with our neighbors near and far? One of the missions they've had going for a little while, but it surprises me every time I turn around, is called Formula for Life. And this was started by a group of folks within the church. And the idea was they had some people over in Mwandi who were having issues buying formula for HIV negative babies whose mothers were HIV positive. And so with that being the case, they couldn't breastfeed. And so what they did is they started raising money to supply the formula by selling necklaces at $5 a pop. And now about 5-6 years later, and several hundred thousands of dollars later, they're still selling necklaces and bags, and they just recently started selling bow ties made out of Mwandi fabric. And every time they go to a craft fair, Catherine Vandergriff comes back and says, "We had a great day. The babies are happy today." So it's a great mission. It's a great ministry and wonderful way to kind of show the heart of the community that I'm privileged to be a part of.
You've written various curricula for The Thoughtful Christian as well as for a variety of periodicals, and you also wrote a book entitled Be Holy, which is a tall order. How do you approach the theme of holiness?
Be Holy. I got to partner with Chalice Press and put out this book, and really the subtitle kind of says it. So Be Holy, find identity, find belonging, find purpose. I think God calls us to be holy, not because God needs us to be holy, or not because God needs mindless worker drones running around the earth. But I think God calls us to be holy for our sakes. I, the Lord your God, am holy. You be holy. And it's a great way for us to look at it. And so with the tagline, find identity, find belonging, find purpose, I think we're set apart. Holiness is a set apart. And so we're set apart from, we're set apart with, and we're set apart for. And when you're set apart from, you find your identity. There are things that we are supposed to be set apart from. There are bad things in this world. So how do we set ourselves apart from that set apart with. We get to be set apart with God, but also with God's people, with the saints, the holy mm-hmm. ones. And then set apart for. I really believe God has a purpose for us here. Each and every one of us, wherever we are, there's always a purpose that God has for us. And so part of our calling to be holy is to live out and to live into that purpose.
Last year, you earned your doctorate, and I understand your work focused on graceful preaching. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, graceful preaching. I was blessed to be a part of the Acts, Demon, and Preaching. So this is the Association of Chicago Theological Schools, and I participated through McCormick, another great institution. And so we got to go and learn from some of the greatest. Eugene Lowry came and gave our colloquium one year. Jennifer Brooks is the dean there now. And we spent a lot of time talking about what does it mean to preach the gospel, and especially what does it mean to give God's grace through your message. Mm. And so graceful in the sense of a couple things. Graceful in grace is full of grace, all about grace, speaking about God's grace to God's graced people. But also graceful in the sense of you don't want to get up in the pulpit and flop all over yourself and distract from that message. And so how are you graceful in the sense of your delivery? And then finally, graceful in the sense of we're preaching in a modern world. Can we gracefully enter this new age and still proclaim God's message mm-hmm. with boldness? And so it was a very fun project and a great program that has pushed me in ways beyond my own imaginings. Mm.
Well, we are in the season of Lent, and last year you wrote a Lenten devotional for Presbyterians Today magazine. So how do you approach this season as we head toward Holy Week and Easter?
Lent is a tremendous season. It's one of the few times in which we get to pause and reflect as a church that is so busy going, going, going all the time, trying to go out and do more. Lent is a season in which we get to really pause and be introspective in a way. Charlie Cowser has a great quote where he talks about to engage Lent and to be engaged by Lent, you have to render yourself vulnerable. Mm. Render oneself vulnerable, he writes. And I've just always thought that was so profound. And so Lent is a time, and I think it goes right along with our calling to be holy, this invitation we have. How do we step into that space with God, all of us, and quit pretending? And just be real, be mm-hmm. vulnerable, and walk with him as God heads towards that Holy Week and beyond.
Well, today your sermon for the third Sunday in Lent draws from John chapter 4, the story of Jesus' encounter with a Samaritan woman at the well. Would you read part of that text for us?
I sure will. The full text comes from John chapter 4, starting at verse 5 through 42, but I'm just going to read 5 through 15, if that's okay. So he, Jesus, came to a Samaritan city called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired out by his journey, was sitting by the well. It was about noon. A Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." His disciples had gone to the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria?" Jews do not share things in common with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God, and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have no bucket, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our ancestor Jacob, who gave us the well, and with his sons and his flocks drank from it?" Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But those who drink of the water that I will give them will never be thirsty. The water that I will give will become in them a spring of water gushing up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water, so that I may never be thirsty or have to keep coming here to draw water." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Brian, we look forward to hearing your sermon. It was about noon. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
Our story today starts with the word so. S-O, so. Two little letters too significant to skip. So is a conjunction here, and the function of this conjunction is to inform you that you are entering a story already underway. So, in this case, implies a causal relationship. It would be as if I said, so, I went to the house on the hill. Or, so, she finally made that trip to Bangladesh. It shows that something has already happened in the narrative, which is now, at least in part, causing what is about to happen. A conjunction with a causal relationship. So, when we begin with the word so, we must realize we begin with a backstory. So, it says, Jesus came to a Samaritan city called Sychar. Jesus had been down in Judea, out in the countryside, with his cousin John. John the baptizer, John the testifier, John the voice of the one crying out. Jesus and John had been down in a little town called Enon near Salim. Enon literally means fresh spring or natural fountain. So for those of you with a more gooder vocabulary than myself, you might already know this is an aquatic sanctuary of sorts. But for those of us who are a bit slower, the text in the previous chapter goes ahead and spells this out for us. It reads, Jesus was baptizing at Enon near Salim because water was abundant there. Water was abundant there. Now, I don't know what your definition of abundant water is. Sounds kind of subjective, doesn't it? I was at Great Wolf Lodge with my daughters a couple weeks ago. It's essentially a hotel with a gigantic indoor water park. And I stood there while a bucket filled with 10,000 gallons of water was dumped over my head from a height of 50 feet. Now that felt like an abundance of water to me, but I know it's all subjective, right? My wife Meg and I once spent some time in Kenya, in a part of that country where you weren't supposed to drink the water before you boiled it and tested it and did all sorts of stuff to it. And I remember coming across a bottle of water, just what we would consider a normal half-liter, 16.9-ounce bottle of water, but it was pure, and it was filtered, and it was clean. And we didn't have to do anything to prep it at all. We just twisted it open and drank. So that, too, for us, in that moment, felt like an abundance of water. We don't know exactly how much water Jesus and John and the disciples had as they were splashing about in the baptismal waters of Enon near Salim, but we know their subjective view because the narrator tells us water was abundant there. Well, not long after this, word about this little sacramental oasis spread, as word often does about good things like this, and word got back to a group of Pharisees that Jesus was baptizing up a storm out there. Jesus figured they'd be coming out that way soon. Jesus knew he'd have to argue minutia law with them. And Jesus decided that he had better ways to spend his next couple of days. So, he left, the text says. He left Judea, started back to Galilee, passing through Samaria on the way. And this is where our passage for the day picks it up. It says, so, Jesus came to a Samaritan city called Sychar. I don't know why, I just like knowing the backstory. I like making these connections. It helps me frame the narrative a bit better. It gives me a new view of what is happening. For instance, the text says that Jesus was tired. Well, he had just traveled a long way. We're not exactly sure how far, but people estimated that it was about 20 to 30 miles. Of course he's tired. He has definitely already gotten in his 10,000 steps for the day and then some. Knowing the backstory makes it more real in a way. I really like knowing the backstory. It says he's tired, so he sits down at the well. And because we know the backstory, we get this irony. You remember from where he had just come with its abundance of water. and you realize that he is now sitting down at a well, which is kind of the opposite of that. If you have to dig a deep hole and lower a bucket into the ground, hoping to find some trickle of an unknown, unseen stream, I think it's safe to say that water is no longer abundant there. Yeah, backstories add depth. They increase our understanding. So when we are given hints or clues by the narrator or whomever, I think they are well worth exploring. And this is especially true when it's Jesus who alludes to a backstory. So Jesus came to a Samaritan city called Sychar. He was tired. He sat down at a well, and as he sat there, the text says, a woman approached. And somehow, in some way, Jesus seemed to know the entire backstory of this woman. Like he knew that she had been married 5 times before. And he knew she had just moved in with someone else. He knew why she tried to avoid everyone else in town. Because he knew the stigma that had been placed upon her long ago. He knew how all this pained her. He knew how she pretended that it didn't. Yeah, Jesus seemed to know the entire backstory of this woman. He knew her question about worship location was really a question about freedom, spirit, and truth. He knew her faith in the Messiah and the one to come was more refined than any of his disciples at that point. He knew she was hopeful, but with hesitation. He knew she was strong, but beginning to waver. He knew her. He knew all of her. I guess this shouldn't be all that surprising to me. I figure Jesus knows all our backstories, perhaps even better than we know our own. And I figure this, I guess in part, because Jesus definitely knew the entire backstory of this woman. He even knew the abundant thirst she had. A thirst she had not yet even realized herself. Dietitians are now saying a large percentage of us are constantly thirsty, but we don't seem to get what this means. Either we sense that our mouth is dry, so we grab a diet soda, which actually dehydrates us more, or we don't realize that it's thirst at all, and we just feel the need to put something in our stomachs, so we grab chips or cookies or containers of carbs that we don't need. They say hunger and thirst trigger the same signals to your brain, and so it is easy to get confused between the two. I wonder if this is, at least in part, what contributed to her abundant thirst on that day. And I wonder if this is, at least in part, what contributes to our abundant thirst this day. Perhaps we too get confused about hunger and thirst. It's easy to do. Notice the disciples went out to get food, but the only thing Jesus said he wanted was a drink. Or perhaps we try to quench our thirst in the wrong ways. I know a guy who first lost his job, then lost his house, and eventually lost his family because his drink of choice for his thirst was his success. And when he wasn't finding it in the normal places that he had become accustomed, he turned to alcohol instead. I know a girl who was so hungry for the attention of her parents that she started cutting herself. She had an abundant thirst, and she thought their approval was the only way to have it satisfied. I once met a woman who channeled her insatiable thirst into controlling others, which caused her to try and manipulate everyone in her life, to the point in which she had no one left in her life. I wonder if sometimes we just can't tell how thirsty we are, if we just don't get what that means. And so then over time, we become abundantly thirsty. And I know we're getting kind of subjective again, but I think this time, you know exactly what I mean. Yes, it can be hard to realize that we are thirsty, but the woman who approached the well eventually also approached an awareness of her thirst. Slowly and cautiously, but she did approach this reality. As Jesus spoke to her, she approached it. As the Spirit moved within her, she approached it. And I also believe it happened as she sensed the time. It was about noon. The text says it was about noon. So, Jesus came to a Samaritan city called Sychar. He was tired. He sat down at a well. And as he sat there, a woman approached. It was about noon. Noontime, solar noon, high noon. That small sliver of temporal space between the a.m. and the p.m. when the sun is at its highest point above the horizon. It was about noon. And if you think about it, at noon, the sun is straight above you. Rays are shining at full volume. It seems to turn up the temperature on things a bit, doesn't it? It was about noon. Shadows are scarce. They're at a minimum. There are fewer places to hide. Hide from others, hide from yourself, hide from reality. It was about noon. The heat and its intensity can begin to feel truly oppressive around this hour. Thirst could easily be at its worst. It was about noon. This is the broad daylight. You are fully exposed. When you are under the blatant, brazen brilliance of noon, things suddenly come to light. Things suddenly become more clear. They are realized. They begin to make sense. It was about noon. We don't know for sure that time of day had a tremendous effect on her sudden realization of her own abundant thirst. But we do know for sure that it had something to do with quenching it. You see, a few chapters later in the Gospel of John, Jesus had just been betrayed, arrested, and denied. Jesus had been beaten, mocked, and struck repeatedly at this point. Jesus was hurting. He was with Pilate. Pilate was talking with Jesus, but Pilate was also talking with the assembled crowd, and the crowd had a hunger on that day. They seemed to be extra hungry for something on that day, because when Pilate told them he found no case against Jesus, the crowd got angry and cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" And so they led him out on a death march, carrying his execution on his back, feeling the effects of that abundant thirst. And the text says it was about noon. This is the only other time in the Bible when that exact phrase is used. When all that took place, it was about noon. I just have to think that there is some sort of correlation here. The same time she realized her abundant thirst is the same time Jesus, once and for all, gave that living water. The same time she realized her need is the same time Jesus met it. And isn't this how it still works? It's when we realize something is lacking that Jesus shows up to provide. As the woman approaches Jesus, Jesus approaches the woman about a drink. She responds with confusion. Jesus says, "If you only knew, you'd ask me the same, and I'd give you living water." Life-giving water, life-sustaining water, the living libations, water. She again shows trepidation. Jesus says, "Well, water is for now, my water is forever. It's a water that never runs out. It's a water that never runs dry. It's an abundant water, you could say." And I know that's a subjective claim, but I think, once again, you know exactly what that means. The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I may never be thirsty." So, he did. Jesus did. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
The Reverend Dr. Brian Coulter was our preacher today. Brian is the senior pastor of First Presbyterian Church in Aiken, South Carolina. His message for the third Sunday in Lent is entitled, It Was About Noon. For a free printed transcript, call us toll-free at 1-888-411-DAY1. That's 888-411-3291. Or write to us at Day 1, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia 30305. To listen again to today's program, share a sermon transcript, or watch inspiring videos, visit us online at dayone.org. And remember, Day 1 depends on the financial contributions of our faithful listeners. If you appreciate our ministry, please consider sending a donation. We're grateful for your much-needed support. I'm Sherry Miller. Next week, we're pleased to welcome the Reverend Scott Seeke, pastor of Amazing Grace Lutheran Church in Lawrenceville, Georgia. His sermon for the fourth Sunday in Lent is entitled, The Chosen One. Be sure to tune in. If you're a preacher or a teacher, make plans now to attend this year's Festival of Homiletics, the premier preaching conference that draws hundreds of preachers from across America and around the world. The 2017 festival will be May 15th through 19th in San Antonio, Texas. You won't want to miss the stellar lineup of outstanding church leaders there. For information, visit dayone.org/festival. Brian Coulter offers some final reflections on today's sermon with our host, Peter Wallace.
Brian, you started your sermon by sharing the backstory of this account in John 4 of Jesus' encounter with a woman at the well. He had just come from Enon, where he and John the Baptist had been baptized, and because there was an abundance of water there. But then Jesus starts back to Galilee, walking many miles through Samaria. He's tired and no doubt thirsty after splashing in that abundant water back in Enon. So there's a great deal of irony in the shift of scenes. And then, of course, he gives the Samaritan woman a promise of abundant living waters. When we find our own situation lacking the abundance that we may have had or that we crave, what might we take from what happens here?
I think the amazing thing with God is that God can start from nothing and make some abundance appear out of nowhere. There's a great mission opportunity I was a part of when I was living in Alabama, in which we had a house that we were about to tear down, and this house was on our lot, and we were thinking about building a parking lot, but for some reason out of nowhere, we decided that we wanted to try something different, and from that, we ended up renting it out with a nonprofit in town that housed people in transition, families that were going from one place to another and needed a steady place to live. Not only did God create a house that was nothing into a house that was full of love and grace and sustenance, but God also gave some amazing families into our congregation through that when I was serving there. I think even when we have nothing left, that's when we truly get to see the abundance that God has.
And of course, Jesus seemed to know this woman's entire backstory, and you figure Jesus knows all our backstories. But the woman may not have even realized she was thirsting for the Spirit, and often we don't realize that either. We try to satisfy our thirst with other things, often harmful things. So what is Jesus saying to us in that?
I think Lent is one of those amazing times when you get to stop and pause and reflect and look at what's going on. I think we do a lot of things that might be good, not great, or we do a lot of things that might be draining the life out of us, but they're very good things still. And so I think Lent is a great time for us to possibly refocus and reshift our attention sometimes. And sometimes there is something bad we need to stop. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's something we need to give up to test to see if that is something we need to keep going with. Mm. Lent is such a great time to practice this idea of maybe God knows our story better than we do. Maybe God is able to redirect us if we're open to it.
Hmm. Brian, what's one thing from your sermon today that you hope our listeners will keep in mind this week?
I guess I would hope that they gauge their thirst level. I think this week I would hope and pray that everybody thinks about what their thirst level is. Hmm. And not only that, but think about the ways in which they have tried to quench it themselves and become unable to do so. I would hope that they think about their thirst levels, but also think about the living water mm-hmm. that is offered so freely to us. And not only offered to us, but take some sips, enjoy, and live into it as we continue through this journey together of Lent.
Brian Coulter, thank you for being with us.
Peter, thank you so much.
Day One is the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches. Visit us online at dayone.org. Our program is recorded and edited by Donald Jones and produced by Peter Wallace. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sherry Miller wishing you all God's blessings on day one and forever.